Welcome to ID the Future. On this episode, Ray Bolin interviews computer scientist Winston Ewart. Ewart, along with William Dembski and Robert Marx, authored Introduction to Evolutionary Informatics, just released. This book discusses information theory, computer simulations, and design for the non-scientist. Buy it today at Amazon.com. Again, that's Introduction to Evolutionary Informatics by Ewart, Dembski, and Marx.
This is Ray Bolin, your host today on ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design. Today I have with me Dr. Winston Ewart to talk about the use of computer simulations to demonstrate the workability of Darwinian evolution. Well, welcome, Winston.
It's great to be here.
Well, let me give you a brief introduction here. Dr. Ewart earned his PhD in computer engineering at Baylor University, where he worked as Dr. Robert Marx's research assistant. He's a senior researcher of the Evolutionary Informatics Lab and senior research scientist at Biologic Institute. He currently primarily works as a software engineer in the Vancouver, British Columbia area. He's published various papers involving computer simulations of evolution, specified complexity, and swarm intelligence. He is a contributor to Evolution News and Views and is returning to ID the Future for the third time. Well, Winston, that sounds pretty impressive.
That's what I tell everyone.
Well, yeah, it always sounds good, doesn't it?
Yes.
Well, since we're here to talk about the workability of Darwinian evolution and computer simulations, I have to be fairly honest. As a biologist, I'm naturally disinclined to accept computer simulations attempting to simulate just about anything biological. Because unlike physical systems, there's just too many variables involved when living things come into play. But as I recall, Richard Dawkins referred to a computer simulation that he thought nicely demonstrated the power of mutation and natural selection. Can you tell us quickly about that program?
So the program you're probably thinking of is the Dawkins Weasel program, and it's presented in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, and it involves the phrase, "Me thinks it's like a weasel." But to tell you the truth, it's really actually not that interesting a program, because immediately after Dawkins presents the program, he says, "Well, life isn't like that." He points out this isn't a good model for evolution. And some other people have, you know, they've picked it up and tried to use it as a model for evolution, but they're actually disagreeing with Dawkins when they do that, because Dawkins himself was clear this doesn't correctly model natural selection. This isn't a good model for evolution. And it's really unfortunate that this simulation gets the attention it does, because there are a lot of other simulations which are much more interesting.
Okay, so you've mentioned there are some other computer simulations of evolution. So can you give us a general description of these programs?
So there are a lot of them. You can go online and search for various computer simulations, and you can Google, say, evolution simulation or something similar. You can find all these different examples. And what you'll find is they're simulating sort of a combination of natural selection and random mutation, and you can run them, and you can typically watch a video or run them on your computer, and you can see, say, a car evolve or a robot or a cell or any number of different things, and you can just run on your computer, and you can see a process of natural selection and random mutation unfolding on your computer, thus demonstrating some sort of Darwinian evolution.
Well, I'm assuming that for some, they're using these simulations to basically attempt to falsify intelligent design. So what are they really trying to accomplish here?
Well, the basic argument they want to say is, how can you deny the power of Darwinian evolution when you can watch evolution unfolding right in front of your face? Right? You can watch the car evolve. You can watch the robot evolve. It seems absurd to them that they don't say, well, actually, Darwinian evolution doesn't really work.
Well, it seems like a pretty powerful analogy. So what's wrong with that argument?
Primarily, it attributes claims to intelligent design proponents that they wouldn't actually make. So no one is saying that a Darwinian process doesn't work under any circumstances at any time in any place. No one is making such a broad brush statement. ID proponents are primarily claiming that Darwinian evolution doesn't work in real life under real world conditions. And I mean, as you referred to, all those variables involved in living things. The claim that ID proponents are making is that it doesn't solve real world biological problems in real world conditions. And since none of these problems are remotely real world conditions or real world problems, it doesn't really prove that intelligent design is incorrect.
Well, it still seemed that these aren't instances of getting design without intelligence. That seems to be what they're still trying to claim. Now, Stephen Meyer has claimed if we trace information back to its source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. Well, if we trace the information in these cars or robots back, don't we come to a computer program, not a mind?
True, but if you trace back one more step, you come to the mind that created the computer program. The claim of intelligent design is never that the immediate source of information has to be intelligent. I mean, when you're listening to this podcast, the information content doesn't come directly from a mind. It comes through a speaker and the internet, et cetera, and a number of things. But eventually, yes, it does trace my mind speaking these words. And so there can be a lot of material process involved along the way, but eventually the information traces back to a mind.
Well, is the car or robot in the simulation essentially the same way that your words are in an MP3 file?
Not exactly. So it's not as if you look inside the program and you'll find, you know, the car or the robot hidden somewhere in the program. But it's not quite that simple. What you find is much more like a seed than a full-grown car. It has sort of the seed, the instruction, the necessary ingredients to produce the car, and it simply needs the combination of randomness and computational processing in order to get from that seed into the actual car.
But a materialist, I think, would still claim that, well, all you need is chance and necessity. If providing the computer equivalent of chance and necessity is sufficient to produce the car, doesn't that support the materialist position?
So it all depends on what's in the seed. Obviously, once you have a seed, all you need is the chance and necessity, and that's true for biological seed, and that's true for these computer seeds. But the question is, where do you get the seed and what's in that seed? So an analogy I like is translation. A computer simulation of evolution is a translation from reality. So reality has features like random mutation and natural selection, and if you translate those into a computer program, we're translating from reality into a computer. So a mind is responsible for translation, but that's not the key thing here, because if a mind is simply translating something, you have to attribute the important features of that to the original. So if you read a translation of Sun Tzu, it would be silly to attribute the insights of Sun Tzu to the translator. But translations don't always work like that. So, for example, if you've found a new set of Egyptian hieroglyphics and a translator translates them and says, you know, this predicted the outcome of the recent contentious presidential election, right? We would suspect that they were not being a good translator, because that seems much more plausible than that this prediction actually happened.
Yes, it does.
So more innocuously, if you like have a translation of poetry, they require a lot of challenge on the part of the translator, because poetry in general doesn't translate. And so any poeticness in a translation has to be due to the translator and not the original. So the point is that it depends on the situation whether something could be attributed to the translation or to the translator or to the original. And so if we look at these computer simulations, they're translations of nature, but they aren't strict translations. If they were to simply stick to what was present in nature, then they could claim to falsify intelligent design. So similarly, these computer simulations are translations of nature, but they aren't strict translations. If they were to simply stick to what was present in nature, they could claim to falsify intelligent design. But, and this is a big but, as long as the seed includes things that aren't taken from nature, you can't claim it's just chance and necessity. It also is the other things you put into that seed.
Okay, well, what sort of other things are included in the so-called seeds?
So they include instances of what I call teleological fine-tuning. Teleological here means end-directed. There's a particular goal in mind. There's a particular purpose in mind. And fine-tuning means the system is one of relatively few states that produce a desired outcome. So as an example, consider a bucket of water perched on a door so that when the door opens, the bucket of water falls on the person going through the door. So this is an example of teleological fine-tuning, because there are a few places where the bucket could be placed which would have that effect, and we are, I think, pretty entitled to conclude that it has to have been deliberately pushed there by someone aiming for that exact effect. We usually think sort of a fine-tuning in the laws of physics, but in the realm of evolution simulations, we're essentially creating a little toy universe that we're sort of watching evolution unfold in with their own laws of physics, and so those laws of physics can be fine-tuned just as our own appear to be. So furthermore, they can be fine-tuned to make evolution work inside these toy universes.
Okay, so in a sense, it seems that these simulations are not exactly representing nature accurately. So what is intelligent design's actual prediction here? What would falsify intelligent design with these simulations?
So intelligent design is noted, claims you can't get design without intelligence. This means you can't get a working evolutionary process, even in this toy universe, unless you will fine-tune that process. If you can build or develop a simulation which lacks any fine-tuning and yet successfully produce artifacts that we would think were designed, then intelligent design's claim would be falsified. So this means when you're developing a simulation, you can't make any decisions for the purpose of making it easier for evolution to produce desired outcome. Because any decision you make like that, that is clearly undirected. It's trying to accomplish a particular goal, and it's tweaking the simulation in order to do what you want. That is clearly a case of teleological fine-tuning.
Okay, so with these simulations that you've been talking about, and this idea of teleological fine-tuning, when you've investigated them, what is it you actually find?
Well, teleological fine-tuning. So in the various papers I've been an author on looking at various simulations, it's invariably in place that the simulations contain aspects that are clearly the result of fine-tuning. In many cases, we even find what happened is that it's documented that when they first made the simulation, it didn't work, and then they made some tweaks that started making it working. And so the fact is, that's probably the clearest example, because if you have to go back after the fact to tweak the rules of your simulation in order to make it work, that's clearly you've engaged in teleological fine-tuning.
Now, that seems pretty clear-cut. Well, so what kind of examples of teleological fine-tuning do we find?
So there are three categories that include most of the common types of teleological fine-tuning. So the first case we have is a distance to target. In that case, natural selection favors virtual organisms that are some way closer to a target. So if you think about an example of a wing, you would say, well, half a wing is better than no wing because it's closer to the target of a full wing. But that's clearly not how natural selection works. Natural selection doesn't measure how good something is based on how close it is to some target, because there's obviously, under natural selection, there is no target that are supposed to be mined. But if you're computing those distances, that has to be what you're doing. You have to have a target in mind that you're measuring the distance to. So any simulation which utilizes distance in this way is unavoidably engaged in the teleological fine-tuning. Now, and if you recall the example of the Dawkins simulation you asked about initially, this is exactly what it does. And Dawkins is clear-headed enough to say, you know, life isn't like this. This isn't a good model of evolution. Now, other people, unfortunately, have not been so clear-headed as Dawkins and have tried to use this kind of simulation as an argument. But a second case is what we might think of as the details of the target. So a simulation doesn't have to necessarily include a distance to the target, how far away it is from the target, but details of what the target is supposed to look like or has to look like in order to solve the problem are built into the simulation. And it could be like something could be simply given to the organism, so it's given this for free, or natural selection could be favor parts of this that don't actually contribute to anything else other than the fact we know that they're eventually going to need to be part of the target, or maybe there's restrictions on the kind of mutations allowed to force this kind of thing. All these sorts of things exist in different simulations. And regardless of the case being, if you incorporate it into the rules of your simulation, details of what you need the target to look like in order to succeed, you've engaged in teleological fine-tuning because you've chosen one of the few sets of rules which favor the kind of things that you need to be in your target. And the last case is developing sort of an evolutionary pathway. And the theory here is that you think about what stages in evolution your thing would have to go through in order to reach the target. And you might sort of think of this as a pathway. You go from stage A to stage B to stage C and stage D, and then you put effort in each stage to make sure that each individual stage can happen. So you sort of have a plan for how evolution proceeds, and then you build the simulation so that it follows that plan. But obviously, I mean, that's teleological fine-tuning. You've come up with a plan for how to reach your target, and then you put that plan into motion. And that doesn't prove anything about what Darwin evolution could do without your help, just that you're capable of producing a useful plan. So all of these different cases, they incorporate some notion of what you're trying to get to and ways that you can fine-tune your simulation in order to reach that.
So we've got computer simulations that are usually in some way involving either a target or they're including some level of the details of what needs to happen or even the sense of a basic pathway, that there are stages that have to be met. And it would seem to me that, at least from my way of thinking, that they've got to be aware to some degree that they are influencing the target and influencing the program to produce what it is they're looking for. So in a way, why are they even doing this? Don't they know that the programs they're writing actually undermines the argument?
Well, I think they're interacting with a simplistic sort of strawman understanding of what intelligent design claims. They want intelligent design to be claiming that Darwin evolution cannot work at all in any circumstances ever. So thus, you know, if you have evolution working at all under any circumstances, obviously, then it would falsify it. But that's not what intelligent design claims, right? So as a metaphor, intelligent design argues that Darwin evolution is sort of like a blind man trying to get his way out of a labyrinth. It simply isn't going to happen. The blind man can't get out of the labyrinth. Even a non-blind man is going to have a hard time, but a blind man is going to be completely lost. So what happens then is that a Darwinist comes along and says, well, that's not true, and they produce a labyrinth, but they block off all of the dead ends, and now a blind man can escape. Well, that doesn't really prove anything, because the point of conflict here isn't whether or not the blind man can escape from an easy labyrinth. The question is the real labyrinth going to be this really trivial case, or is it going to be much more complicated with all sorts of dead ends and other problems that make it really hard to escape? So evolution can solve a lot of problems if you make them easy. But the question that really is the point of conflict here is, are problems that easy? And intelligent design has argued repeatedly, no, the problems simply aren't that easy.
Well, Winston, I think you've made an excellent case that the computer simulations so far that we've seen that are trying to model what evolution can accomplish seem to be fraught with a lot of problems, fine-tuning built into it. It's been a great conversation with you, and glad you were with us today. And let me just remind everybody, this is Ray Bolin for ID the Future, and thank you for being with us.
Want to learn more? Read Introduction to Evolutionary Informatics by Ewart, Dembski, and Marx, available now on Amazon.com. Again, that's Introduction to Evolutionary Informatics. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.